May it please the court.
Certainly.
My name is Leslie Hazel with the Public Defender's Office, and I represent Kendrick Tipler. Article 1, Section 18C, cannot be applied in a way that would take away or impair rights which had vested before it was enacted. Specifically, Section 18C cannot be applied to Mr. Tipler's future trial because it is a substantive law, and substantive laws are presumed to operate prospectively. This court has long held that substantive laws are laws which take away or impair vested rights acquired under existing laws. Opposing counsel will argue that Section 18C is an evidentiary rule based in part on the title of the amendment. Essentially, the state argues that Mr. Tipler's substantive rights are not affected by this amendment. That argument is simply incorrect. This court has clearly explained exactly which rights Mr. Tipler will be losing when it struck down a statute that was almost identical to Section 18C in Ellison. In Ellison, this court explained that that statutory embodiment of this amendment, which was Section 566.025, was unconstitutional because it took away or impaired rights enshrined in Missouri Constitution's Sections 17 and 18A. Specifically, the statute impaired a defendant's right to be tried only for the offense with which he is charged, and the right to be charged by either an indictment or an information. Section 18C impairs those same rights.
So do you agree that if it were simply an evidence rule, that you don't look back and see what those rules were at the time of the crime, but you think it goes beyond being an evidence rule?
I think that's exactly correct, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In fact, if we read the text of the amendment, it tells us exactly which rights the amendment is taking away before we even get to the first comma. The amendment begins with, quote, "Notwithstanding the provisions of Section 17 and 18A of this article to the contrary," so regardless of the constitutional protections provided in Sections 17 and 18A, this new amendment prevails. An amendment which tells us in its own text that it's taking away other constitutional rights cannot be called simply evidentiary. This is clearly a substantive law. This is not the first time this court has considered whether an amendment impairs a vested right. In Kyle, for example, this court considered the retroactive application, and then that's cited in my opponent's brief, the retroactive application of a constitutional amendment which allowed defendants to be charged with either an indictment or an information. In that case, this court spent several paragraphs making a distinction between amendments that were simply procedural amendments and amendments which take away or impair rights of defendants. This court reasoned that if applying the amendment retroactively would be unjust or oppressive or would take away safeguards guaranteed to the defendant, then it could not be applied retroactively. Now, in that particular case, this court found that the amendment in question did none of those things, and therefore it could be applied retroactively. But in this case, the amendment would take away safeguards guaranteed to the defendant. It would deprive him of substantive rights, and therefore Section 18C cannot be applied to this case. In his brief, opposing counsel also mentioned the Sears case. However, Sears does not give us any guidance that would be helpful in our case today. In fact, this court stated that the arguments made by both parties in that case regarding prospective and retroactive application of the law were missing the point at issue. Opposing counsel points to one particular sentence in that case which states, quote, "There is no question that the rules of evidence in effect at the time of the trial govern." Again, that sentence provides no guidance to our case because our case does not involve a simple rule of evidence. It involves a constitutional amendment that takes away or impairs substantive rights of defendants.
Well, it's also a rule of evidence, but you're saying it does more than that.
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, it would be absurd for me to say that this rule isn't about evidence. It's certainly about evidence, but it's much more than just a procedural rule or a rule about evidence that doesn't affect rights.
You've talked about a lot of different cases, but what's the relevant point in a criminal proceeding determining whether or not the law is retrospective? Is it when the crime was committed? Is it when the defendant is charged? Or is it the time of trial? And why is that a difference?
I think that's a great question, Your Honor, and my opponent uses the phrase triggering event, which I did not find anywhere in my review of the case law. I believe the relevant moment we need to look to is the moment when the defendant became vested with the rights that this amendment is now looking to take away. Mr. Tipler, in this particular case, was vested with the protections of Article 17 and 18A prior to the amendment of prior to the enactment of this amendment. That's the relevant time frame. Now, my opponent will likely argue that because Mr. Tipler's trial is in the future, applying this amendment to his trial is in fact prospective. However, if we carefully examine the cases he uses to support that position, the argument falls short, and I would like to discuss three of those cases, starting with McCoy. In McCoy, this court considered the retroactive application of a constitutional amendment which declared the right to bear arms an inalienable right. In that case, this court explained that absent an explicit contrary intent, this court will only give prospective application to constitutional amendments. Now, McCoy only briefly addressed this issue, but if we look at Hall and Scott, this court provides us with more details. In Hall, this court considered the retroactive application of a constitutional amendment which set an age limit for judges. In that case, this court rejected an argument which was very similar to the argument my opponent is making today. Specifically, the argument was that the new constitutional amendment could be used to terminate a judge's position in the future because it was happening in the future and therefore it was prospective. This court stated that such an argument was not valid and held that judges who were elected prior to the passage of the amendment were to retain office for the full term for which they had been selected. In other words, the judge's right to hold these positions had vested before the amendment was passed, and therefore the amendment could not be used to take away their ability to serve that full term.
Similarly, why isn't your concern addressed by the last sentence, which says that the court can consider the probative value versus prejudice? So if it is, and in doing that, naturally what one thing it would look at was whether it was the danger of unfair prejudice would be because it would encourage the jury to determine the case based on something other than the charges, wouldn't it be?
I think that's an interesting point, Your Honor, and something particular about the way this amendment is written versus what we've seen in other states is that provision says the court can, or I believe it may use the word may. There's no order that the court shall consider the probative versus prejudicial
but
value.
Doesn't that support the fact that this is really just a constitutional rule of evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that does
it
not.
It looks like the normal definition of relevancy to me, or at least it was when I went to law school.
Well, again, I think it's important that it says may rather than shall, and I think it's also important that section we have before the first comma saying that Section 17 and 18A are basically trumped by this new amendment.
Prior to the amendment, it was absolutely prohibited to admit evidence for the purpose of showing propensity to commit the crime. So, and this constitutional amendment changes that law and allows evidence of a defendant's propensity to commit crimes of a sexual nature. So that changes. I'm trying to decide if that is evidentiary. It seems not to be evidentiary.
I would agree with you, Your Honor. I think this goes much further than, of course, it's a rule about evidence. Again, it would be absurd for me to say it's not a rule about evidence.
Well, aren't you saying it's a rule of evidence, but it affects substantive rights in a way which is unconstitutional or which is inconsistent, certainly, with our prior case?
Well, I believe that for it to be a rule of evidence in the sense that my opponent will argue, it has to not affect substantive rights. So in the sense that it affects substantive rights, that moves it out of the realm of simply being a rule of evidence. Now,
well, did the people have the right to amend the Constitution to say this?
Certainly they do, Your Honor, and I am not here today to argue that the amendment is unconstitutional or wasn't validly enacted. I'm simply arguing that it does not apply to cases where the crime is alleged to have committed prior to the passage of the amendment.
So you're not arguing pro or con that it violates any U.S. constitutional rights?
Not today, Your Honor. That's not the fight I'm fighting today.
Okay, so in a hypothetical situation, Count one, the crime occurred before the effective date. Count two, the crime occurred after the effective date. Would propensity evidence be admissible?
Well, Your Honor, I think that is an issue that would come up only rarely. And I believe that there are a number of cases that exist right now where the crime is alleged to have occurred before the amendment was passed, but we will, in the near future, have all of those cases cleared up. So this won't be a continuing problem, but I can certainly acknowledge that there may be situations where there would be a count before the amendment and a count after the amendment, and certainly I'm sure the circuit court would look to this court for guidance if that were to occur.
In those cases, if the court were to exclude the evidence because of its prejudicial effect, would we even need to reach the question of whether it was excluded under the historic common law or excluded under this provision?
Well, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think that's very different from what we're addressing today. We're dealing with a situation where the lower court, the trial court, has determined that the evidence of Mr. Tipler's prior conviction is somehow probative and more probative than prejudicial of the upcoming trial, an opinion which I respectfully disagree with. But
in a motion in limine, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
And do we usually take up the correct or incorrect nature of motions in limine?
Well, Your Honor, I believe, and I should correct myself, it was not a motion to limit in limine. Judge Gardner granted the state's motion and notice of intent to introduce this evidence, and I had filed a motion in limine, so it was sort of addressing both of those motions. But a writ of prohibition can be used to prevent unnecessary, inconvenient, and expensive litigation. Here we're talking about Mr. Tipler's second trial. If we're to wait until if he were convicted and then appeal this issue, we would perhaps have to have a third trial, which would be certainly unfortunate for Mr. Tipler, but also for the victim in this case. In a bigger sense, we need to think about the cases statewide. There are numerous cases across the public defender system alone that are waiting for the outcome of this case to determine how to move forward. In cases involving sexual contact with a minor are especially difficult and expensive to litigate.
Is there anything that required the state to file that type of notice that they intended to use this type of evidence?
Well, Your Honor, I think that was perhaps in response to my motion to exclude the particular evidence.
Yeah, wouldn't this type of ruling wouldn't even want to preserve the issue for appeal after trial, assuming you didn't preserve your objections all the way through?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, there would be more things I would need to do to correctly preserve this issue for appeal.
Are you familiar with any case where this court issued a writ just upon a pre-evidentiary ruling that a court made on a motion in limine in a civil or criminal case?
Well, Your Honor, I do not, but I'm also not at the appellate office, so perhaps my knowledge of that topic is somewhat limited. I believe I am out of time.
Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. What this case is really about is the orderly administration of justice and the uniform applicability of rules of evidence. Judge Russell, your question about a two-count indictment is a perfect example of what sort of misunderstandings can arise in the system if the court adopts Mr. Tipler's position. But there's an even more drastic example. In a child sexual case, the state is allowed to charge based on a range, a date range. So it would certainly be possible that the state, with a child victim who can't give a specific day, could charge that the offense occurred between Halloween and Christmas. In that situation, there's only one count. But it's completely unclear if the court adopts Mr. Tipler's position as to which rule of evidence would apply. The Kyle case, I think, really is a perfect example of why, if there is a right that Article 1, Section 18C implicates, it's a procedural right. This court in Ellison and its predecessors talk about how the right to be tried only on the offense charged derives from Article 1, Section 17. Kyle, of course, is a case about the voters amending the previous version of the Constitution. In fact, including or enlarging what is now Article 1, Section 17. That was a procedural right then. Article 1, Section 18A gives the defendant the right to essentially file a bill of attainder to demand the nature of charges before trial. That's a procedural right as well. So,
are you claiming that the constitutional provision gives you the right to try the defendant for a crime other than with the crime with which they're charged?
No, Your Honor. And my understanding is that the rule that's discussed in Ellison, Voorhees, and its predecessor cases, the rule of evidence is a mechanism that the court has created to protect that right. Here, that mechanism has been changed, but that certainly doesn't prevent the court from, you know, issuing a model jury instruction or some other procedural avenue. Returning, though, to the issue of retroactivity, prospective application, this is a rule of evidence. The trial has not yet occurred. So it cannot be retroactive to apply a rule of evidence to a trial that has not yet occurred. There was a question earlier about when the right would have attached. Did it attach at the time of the charge? Did it attach at the time of the offense? Or does it attach at the time of trial? These rights, Article 1, Section 17, and Article 1, Section 18A, are trial rights. They're rights that vest at the time of trial, not rights that vest at the time of the charge or the time of the offense. The defendant certainly can't assert a violation of his right to be tried only on the offense he's charged when he's being interrogated by the police or when he's being investigated. Those are the type of rights that would attach at the time of the offense. So to the extent that if the court believes that there is some sort of right that is being impaired by Article 1, Section 18C, that's certainly a right that would attach at the time of trial. And, of course, trial has not yet occurred. And so Article 1, Section 18C can't implicate, to the defendant's detriment, those rights.
What do you opposing counsel noticed that the word may rather than shall is used in the constitutional amendment in addressing the trial court's obligation to weigh propensity versus probative value versus prejudice. Can you address that and if that affects our analysis?
I think it has no outcome on the analysis in this case. Traditionally, there is a difference between a may and a shall being a mandatory duty and a may being permissive. But this is an issue of evidence. And this court's precedents and the statutes recognize that the trial judge has immense discretion when considering evidence. And I think the use of the word may by the people just is merely a reaffirmance of the fact that the trial court, in almost every other situation, has virtually unlimited discretion to consider evidence. The trial court is in the best position to consider the impact of Mr. Tipler's conviction for endangering the welfare of a child.
Would we have to overrule parts of Voorhees or Ellison to agree with you, talking about it affecting substantive rights?
No, because Voorhees and Ellison are cases about the statute. This would be a case about the constitutional amendment. So to the extent that there might be some conflict, I think if Voorhees and Ellison have been overruled, it was by the vote of the people, not by any decision from this court. My view of the adoption of Article 1, Section 18C, is that it's a perfect example of how democracy works. This court gave the people and the legislature guidance in Burns, in Ellison, in Voorhees, about what the rules of evidence are, what the strictures of the Missouri Constitution are. And the people and the General Assembly followed those instructions and used the mechanisms available to them to make that change. Because all of the judicial power and all of the legislative power, at the end of the day, derives from the people.
Can't rules of evidence also affect substantive rights?
Well, I think every rule of evidence will ultimately affect a substantive right in the sense that the evidence that's admitted changes the outcome of the trial. But this isn't a rule that affects a substantive right like some of the rules cited in Mr. Tipler's brief. Mr. Tipler talks about at least two examples, one being a wrongful death situation, the other being a workers' compensation notice requirement. Those situations change the act. The wrongful death now has a different effect because of the cap. The injury is different because of the notice requirement. Here, Article 1, Section 18C changes nothing about Tipler's alleged offending.
How is propensity evidence ever relevant?
How is it logically relevant or legally relevant?
How can its probative value ever outweigh its prejudicial effect? For what valid purpose can it be introduced?
Well, certainly there is some probative value that it has.
And what is that, I'm asking you?
These cases are different, I think, than most other cases. This isn't a robbery case where there might be evidence of a broken window or a burglary case. These cases involve children. And I think the fact that somebody has been charged...
So you're saying it's relevant to pattern or practice, or you're saying because he did it before, he probably did it now?
I think that if somebody has been accused or convicted of this particular type of offense, that does have probative value as to whether or not they have committed the offense that they're currently charged. That's the rule that's recognized in the other 49 states. That's the rule that the federal government has recognized in the Federal Rule of Evidence. I understand that that is an exception to the general ban on propensity evidence and the reasons set forth for that.
Is this limited to sexual prosecutions, this amendment?
This is limited to not only sexual prosecutions, but prosecutions where the victim is a child. So in the federal rules of evidence, this type of evidence would be admissible in a case where the defendant is alleged to have raped an adult
woman. It's character evidence, in effect, you're saying.
It's evidence that helps give the jury the complete picture of the defendant in this case, his past conduct, and how that interplays with the conduct that he is charged to have committed. I think that this is a situation where the people have decided they want that complete picture. They want to be able to have this evidence. And they've come up with a system. They put it in the Constitution. As far as my research has revealed, this is the only rule of evidence that's been enshrined in the Missouri Constitution. And I think that's a particular demonstration of how important the people of the state of Missouri thought that this rule was. There's been some discussion about the McCoy case. McCoy is part of a series of cases that I think the most recent decision is Robinson from February from this court that talk about the prospective application of these kind of constitutional amendments. But McCoy is very different from the situation we have here. In McCoy and in the following cases, the defendant was arguing that the amendment to Article 1, Section 23 legalized his conduct. That's not what's being argued here. So, in other words, McCoy is dealing with a situation where the Missouri constitutional change has now legalized what was illegal before. This, again, changes not Mr. Tipler's alleged conduct. It only enlarges the scope of possible evidence. Article 1, Section 23 doesn't even demand that the evidence be introduced, and I think many trial judges will take a lot of responsibility in their decision to weigh whether the evidence is more prejudicial than probative. So the reliance on McCoy and its principle, I think, is misplaced here because we're dealing with a different animal. This is a rule of evidence. There was some discussion about the introductory clause, the notwithstanding clause. This court's cases have held that when interpreting statutes and constitutional amendments, the court will presume that the legislature is aware of the law and that an amendment to the law operates in existence to change the law that at the time of the amendment. So that notwithstanding clause has to have some meaning. If the clause wasn't there, Article 1, Section 17 and Article 1, Section 18A would be overridden by Article 1, Section 7, Article 1, Section 18C. Even without the notwithstanding clause, the rule would be changed. The evidence could be admissible if, as in this case, the standard was met. And I just want to end, unless there are some other questions, with sort of where we began, with the fact that this is a rule of evidence. For over 100 years, this court has held that the rule of evidence that's in effect at the time of trial controls that trial. If the court adopts Mr. Tipler's position, there will not be one uniform rule of evidence until 2061, based on the statute of limitations. For these kind of crimes, the statute of limitations is 30 years plus the amount of time it takes for the victim to reach 17. So for a crime committed against an infant in 2014, that's that 47-year period reaches to 2061. Kyle's talks about the fact that having different rules like that leaves prosecutors, defendants, courts groping in the dark for the right answer. If we don't have one uniform rule of evidence, like in this case, the system will be left in the same position. Thank you.
You cited a case I don't see in your brief from this court. Was it the Robinson case?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you'd send a letter to the court with a copy to your counsel with that cite, please.
I will. Thank you, Your Honor.
May I please report? I certainly don't want to get too far off of my argument here, but I would like to address a question that the court asked of my opponent. I'm of the opinion that propensity evidence is so prejudicial that its prejudicial nature can never be outweighed by its probative value.
Isn't it true that there are scientific studies that suggest a higher rate of recidivism for those who are convicted of sex crimes against children than other types of crime?
I believe.
And we use science all the time to help us find the truth in these cases. What makes it? Why should we ignore the scientific studies in this area?
Your Honor, I believe that those scientific studies are widely misunderstood. For example, people who steal automobiles have a much higher rate of recidivism than people who commit sex crimes. However, I don't have any of those studies in front of me.
Well, if that's true, doesn't that cut against your propensity being probative?
I think it supports it. This court, and there's no constitutional amendment in question for a defendant who's stolen vehicles in the past, but certainly we would agree that the fact that he's stolen a vehicle in the past doesn't help us decide whether he's stolen a vehicle in an upcoming trial, and I believe the same logic applies. But to return to my point, the guiding principles throughout the cases we've discussed today is that constitutional amendments cannot be applied in a way that will take away or impair rights which had vested before the amendment was enacted. As I stand here today, I'm not charged with a crime, but certainly I'm protected by Constitutional Amendment Article 1, Section 17 and 18C, perhaps in a negative sense in that I'm not charged with a crime that's not allowed under those provisions. I believe all Missouri citizens are currently vested with those rights until and unless something happens to divest them. And given this new constitutional amendment, the only way that can be done is if they fall under the provisions of Section 18C.
Regarding science and the propensity research, Voltaire said, "The rich and the poor equally have the opportunity to sleep under a bridge." The rich just don't choose to do it. It often is the poor might say, I'm going to rob someplace because I don't have any food. That's not necessarily science. It's basically environment, and there's always that mix between them. Unless you're dealing with H2 plus oxygen creates water, nothing is very it's not as scientific as you might think.
And Your Honor, I would agree with that, and I believe that the science that was cited to you by the court, I believe it does not at all support the position that Mr. Tipler is somehow more likely to have committed the case which we received a hung jury on at the first trial because of...
And so if it did, would that be sufficient to support this amendment?
No, Your Honor, I believe it would not. The same problem exists. If we just look at the text leading up to the comma, the rights that's being taken away by this amendment. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you, Justice.
Case will be submitted.